Welcome to Constant Wonder. I'm your host, Marcus Smith. In this special Mother's Day edition, grandmothers will take center stage. We start in Appalachia. You know, the story behind Hillbilly Elegy has gotten a lot of attention with Glenn Close's Oscar nomination. The film, the book, take a gritty, tragic look at a dysfunctional Appalachian community. But there's another memoir that also describes escaping generational poverty in a similar community. But this one has a softer lens. In Hill Women, Finding Family and a Way Forward in the Appalachian Mountains, we meet the hardworking, resourceful, and creative mother and grandmother who helped the author get to Harvard Law and back. Later in the hour, we'll meet the creator of the wildly popular Pasta Grannies, the YouTube channel where millennials are learning to make homemade pasta from Italian grannies. But first, here's our conversation with Cassie Chambers Armstrong, a lawyer in rural Kentucky. Constant Wonder producer Tenery Taylor talked with her about that memoir, Hill Women. And we should say that during the interview, Armstrong had her three-week-old baby Mills on her lap. So we're really getting a four-generation story here.
Welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you for having me, and thanks for letting Mills tag along for the interview.
It is our pleasure. Just tell me, were you thinking about Hillbilly Elegy when you wrote your own story?
You know, I think I was, in the sense that I didn't realize that I had a story that anyone would be interested in listening to until I read Hillbilly Elegy and I saw the way it resonated with such a wide swath of America and it became so popular. And seeing that, it sort of made me aware of the fact that people had an interest in hearing about Appalachia and hearing about Appalachian stories. But of course, after I read it, I was sort of left with this impression that it's great people are hearing about Appalachia, but I don't feel like they're hearing about the Appalachia that I know from this particular account.
So introduce us to the place you came from. Owsley County, is that how you say it?
Yes. Most people don't pronounce it correctly. I think you might be the first the first time. But yes, it's Owsley County, Kentucky. It is by sort of median household income, the poorest county in the continental United States. It's a place that struggles with issues like finding good jobs, educational opportunities. The poverty there is quite extreme, but it's also a place that I believe has a lot of beauty and a lot of creativity and a lot of just downright gritty people who are working so hard to survive in really challenging circumstances. And so I wanted to sort of be able to show the world both sides of Owsley County, both the challenges, but also the real opportunity and possibility that exists there.
You've called this an anti-bootstrap narrative, and I wonder if you could tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, I think so often, you know, my story looks like it and could be fit into that sort of bootstrap narrative type where, you know, I was born into poverty. My parents took me home from the hospital to a rented trailer in a trailer park that they couldn't afford to run the air conditioner in. And despite that, you know, and my parents were very young at the time they had me. They were both college students. And despite that, I was able to go on and earn a degree from Yale College and eventually from Harvard Law School. And I think it's very easy to simplify those types of narratives and say, you know, it's about working hard. It's about individuals sort of pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. But that misses, in my opinion, sort of all of the work that happened behind the scenes to really make that sort of change in my family possible. And in Hill Women, I try to talk about the fact that it really took three generations of women, each one working harder to sort of be able to provide opportunities for the next generation, for me to even be able to have the opportunities that I did. So in a lot of ways, it wasn't anything about what I did or me being motivated or me being so great or achieving or overcoming. It was sort of the culmination of generations and generations of women working really hard to make it possible.
Well, let's start the conversation then a couple generations back where you started with Granny. And I love – there's a story that I love that I think will really paint a picture of what a unique person she was. Will you tell us the tree frog story?
Oh, yeah. When I was little, my granny knew that I'd been wanting a pet tree frog. And she was just really a woman who believed that you kind of get things done yourself. And Just a real sort of, if there's something that needs taken care of, she was going to take care of it. And so I remember as a child, I'd been sort of looking, trying to find a pet tree frog. You know, my granny was older. She certainly had health issues, mobility issues. And I remember one day coming back from the creek and finding her a solid 10 feet off the ground, sort of all legs akimbo up in a tree, grabbing a tree frog for me to have as a pet because, you know, in her mind, it was like, well, my granddaughter wants a tree frog. There's a tree frog. I'm going to go get it. She didn't think about her arthritis or, you know, how she was going to get down from the tree. She just sort of went up and got the frog and down she came with it.
Now tell us kind of her story where, you know, tell us maybe the kind of family she was from, how old she was when she got married.
Yeah. So my granny sort of grew up in really what I think is the most extreme poverty that you could think of in terms of what rural poverty looks like in America. She was able to go to school till the third grade, at which point her family really needed her to help out on the farm. She never had a childhood in the sense that we think about childhood today. You know, she was never able to play or go to the movies or even really play outside. Most of her life was spent working in the fields. She lived in a house that, you know, was so cold at night that her blankets used to freeze. But even though she didn't have a lot of opportunities, she certainly didn't have a lot of educational opportunities, she knew that she wanted to create better opportunities for her children, and she wanted them to be able to get an education. And so from the time, you know, she was married at 16, started having children shortly thereafter. And even in sort of that young stage of her life, she started immediately working to be able to provide better opportunities for her children than she had had.
Give me an example of what she did that was maybe a little bit unique.
So she immediately started telling my mother from the time that she was very young that she was going to graduate high school and go to college. And that was something that was really unusual in Owsley County at the time.
Even the graduating from high school was unusual.
Yes, even the graduating from high school was unusual back then, in part because there wasn't really a lot of opportunity, and the opportunities didn't necessarily change based on whether you'd graduated high school or not. And so in a lot of ways, you know, when families were struggling, most people were tobacco farmers or, you know, coal miners. And when the ability to get those jobs didn't depend on sort of having a higher education, a lot of families needed their children. And a lot of children made the decision to help out their families and sort of enter the workforce and start helping out around the household when they were when they were younger, before they had finished their education.
And your grandfather was twice Granny's age when he began courting her. But you're right that that wasn't unusual. And can you explain that? Because I think it's really important to understand in terms of the economy there.
It's a really interesting thing. And it's something that I still sort of grapple with, as my papa was sort of in his 30s when he started courting my granny, who was 16 at the time. And you think about this sort of imbalance in life experiences and power dynamics and sort of just being in different places in the world, and how unacceptable we would think that that is in a lot of cultures today. Certainly, you know, in my community, that would be something that we would say, oh, my goodness, that's just totally unacceptable, and be sort of outraged by. Mm. But there was a real sense back then that, you know, daughters were almost a liability. Unmarried daughters were a liability. They weren't as good at helping out in the tobacco fields. They weren't sort of seen as being as efficient workers as sons were. And so families had this incentive where they really wanted to sort of cling to their sons, keep their sons around to help out on the family farm, but they wanted to marry their daughters off as young as possible and as early as possible. And so it created a situation where a lot of times you did have much older men who had been helping out on their family farm, ending up marrying really girls, you know, younger mm-hmm. girls mm-hmm. who, their families were sort of eager to get them sort of married off and out of the household, because in some circumstances they really couldn't necessarily afford to keep feeding them and housing another person.
I think we need to talk about the tobacco and the coal mining industries that, even when they were thriving, needed young children to help bring in the harvest. But they saw a change that really impacted Appalachia. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Tobacco farming used to be one of the things because tobacco had sort of these price controls that kept the price higher. It was something that people could run small farms, small family farms in Kentucky and still make a profit doing. And a lot of the farmland in Appalachia, because it's so sort of hilly and mountainous, there's not sort of this big flat open area that you can farm. A lot of it's sort of the area in between hills, these sort of hollers or bottoms, you'll hear people refer to them as. But because of sort of the way that the price controls were set up, you could sort of grow a smaller crop and still be able to make a profit. And that industry changed in, I believe, the late 1990s, and the price controls went away. And that sort of meant that these smaller farms were no longer a viable way for families to make a living. And of course, tobacco farming, it had always been sort of a family industry. It was sort of, you needed all your kids to engage in sort of the labor intensive nature of it. It was, one family worked one farm and that was how you provided for everyone. And that really sort of destroyed the economy of parts of Appalachia when that industry went away, because again, it wasn't like people could come in and grow corn or soybeans or some other crop just because of the way that the land was, the sort of smaller parcels and the geography of the land. And of course, similarly with coal mining, that was an industry that also used to be really important to Appalachia and then declined over time, in part because all of the coal that had been sort of easy to get to had been extracted, and it was sort of easier to mine coal from other parts of the country. So Appalachia is really a place where the two big industries that people could make a living doing, have disappeared over the past couple of decades. And it's a region that's trying to figure out what comes now and what comes next, and how you fill this vacancy.
And how did your own family approach that challenge, especially Granny and her children as they grow up?
It's definitely been a challenge. The way I think about it is there aren't sort of these big industries that have come to Appalachia to replace coal and tobacco. It's really more of creating jobs in these smaller one-off opportunities. And so, after the tobacco farming sort of left and that was no longer a way for my family to make a living, my Aunt Ruth, one of Granny's kids, went to work at the Dollar General store because that was one of the few jobs that was available in town. Other relatives, school systems are one of the major employers there. So I have relatives that are cooks at the Owsley County school system, relatives that work for city government, driving dump trucks, things like that. But as you can imagine, those are sort of these one-off jobs, and there's not really any industry that's come in and sort of been able to provide jobs on the same scale that tobacco and coal mining were.
Would you say that Granny had a happy life in spite of all of this?
She did. I think that's one of the things that I wanted to show people about people that live in poverty by writing Hill Women, is although Granny didn't have a childhood, married at such a young age, she managed to find joy in everything she did. She was the type of person that would put on her bluegrass music and sing and dance as she cleaned the house every single day, and would laugh as often as she could and love to tell jokes. And so I think there's this sense sometimes that people who live in poverty, people only think of them as victims and they only see sort of the sadness. And I don't mean to suggest that, it's really sad that we have people living in poverty in America. But there's still complex people. There's still people that have joy in their lives and make choices and love their families. And I think sort of showing that people can be poor and still sort of have joy and find joy is something that we don't really see a lot of portrayals of.
If you're just joining us, this is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor, and we're talking to Cassie Chambers Armstrong. She's a lawyer who works with clients in rural Kentucky, and her new memoir is Hill Women: Finding Family and a Way Forward in the Appalachian Mountains. I would like to start to move the conversation into your mother's generation, and I'd like you to tell me about the influence of Dr. Bob.
Dr. Bob was really the person that I think changed my life as much as anyone has, by the way that he changed my mother's life. He was a physician who sort of treated people in Owsley County for free a lot of times. A lot of people didn't have health insurance. And back then, you know, the opportunities to get health insurance were much more limited. And so he, through his free practice, came to know my mom, know my mom's family, know that, you know, they lived in extreme poverty, and also be able to see that my mom was an incredibly bright and gifted child. And he really pushed her to take advantage of educational opportunities, to go to summer camps, where she learned about going to college, where she interacted with people who had been to college. And he encouraged her to apply to college, to Berea College, which is just an incredible institution in Appalachia that really works with low-income first-generation Appalachian college students, to be able to provide them with a tuition-free education, and a really high-quality education at that.
And he didn't want her going to the junior college.
That's right. So my mom originally, when Dr. Bob started saying you should apply to college, my mom thought, oh, I'll go to the junior college close to home and live at home. And Dr. Bob put his foot down and said, no, you're going away. You're going to sort of get out of this environment so that it feels harder to come back home, and so that you see what life is like outside of this holler and you see what opportunities are there. And she did it. And she went to Berea College, and that changed her life. That changed my life. It helped her really understand the way education opens horizons. And I think for her, the jump from Owsley County, from the holler that she had grown up in, to a small town of Berea with, you know, 15,000 people, she thought that that was just a whole new world, and the world had opened up to her. And because of that, she truly believed that there was no jump, no horizon, no part of the world that was too broad or too far for me to be able to go to. And she instilled that in me from a very young age.
But she has you when she is... You said in college, she and your dad both still in college. Did she ever, I mean, she's already doing something that's so hard and so different from what anyone else in her family's done. I mean, graduating from high school in the first place, now she's in college. Now she's having a baby while she's in college. Was she overwhelmed?
I think about that a lot because I have an 18-month-old and a 3-week-old, like you said at the top of the show, and I, you know, I am in my mid-30s, and I've been able to sort of grow up and put in place systems to help me navigate life, sort of having a family and having other obligations. And I think sometimes about how scary it must have been for my mom to be a teenager in this whole new world that she hadn't really wrapped her mind around what it meant to be outside of Owsley County and to be at college. And then throwing a husband and a baby into the mix. I can't imagine what it must have been like. But, you know, she always found a way to balance them both. I do know that right after she had me, I think she contemplated quitting college and just staying home with me and just sort of letting the educational piece go. But it was really Granny and her sister, Ruth, who also didn't have the chance to go to college. They really pushed her and they said, no, this is, you know, you want what's best for your daughter. You want to build a life for your daughter and build a life for your family. You've got to finish your education because this is how that happens.
And how did they help her accomplish that? They had a lot to do with your raising when you were really young, I think.
They did. You know, because my mom and my dad were both college students, I spent a lot of time in Owsley County with my family there, as my parents sort of navigated classes and finals and all of the things that they had to do, you know, job interviews and whatnot. And so I would sometimes spend, you know, a week at a time in Owsley County, and I loved it there. It was, there was nothing more fun than playing on the farm and spending time with my extended family. And, I never thought of it as being sort of sent away. I just thought of it as, all these people were part of my orbit. And now having kids myself, I can understand how lucky I was. I think it really does take a village to raise a child. And in today's world, as we've seen with everything going on in the pandemic, especially, it can be sort of harder to find your village than perhaps it was in other times.
And you'll have to tell us, we have to take a quick break, but I want to hear this story of your mom's graduation, which was also kind of like your graduation.
It definitely was, yes. So my mom graduated from college when I was 5 years old, and her education had been something I'd been a part of from the very beginning. When I was very young, she would take me with her to classes and take me around campus, and I would eat in the dining hall with her. And so when she graduated college, I thought that it was my graduation as well. I got a little cap and gown, and I marched in the parade with her. And I told everyone, we're graduating. My mom and I are graduating. And it's interesting because it really was such a monumental occasion for both of us that marked this really important family event that at the time I didn't realize, but in hindsight, it really was both of us graduating on to the next stage of life.
We need to take a quick break here on Constant Wonder. We've been speaking with Cassie Chambers Armstrong, a lawyer who works with clients in rural Kentucky. She's also the former vice chair of the Kentucky Democratic Party. Her memoir, Hill Women, Finding Family and a Way Forward in the Appalachian Mountains, is the topic of our conversation today. And when we come back, we'll hear about why she chose to go back to Kentucky after graduating from Harvard Law. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor, and our guest is Cassie Chambers Armstrong. She's the author of Hill Women, Finding Family and a Way Forward in the Appalachian Mountains. Now, you ended up attending Ivy League schools, and I think you were kind of prompted to apply out of a little bit of maybe, I don't know if it was spite, that might be too strong of a word, but it was a defiant move on your part, I think. Will you tell us about that?
I actually started my career at Wellesley College, and it's a great school. And I started dating someone who went to an Ivy League school. And it was someone that sort of held that fact over me and used it a lot to sort of set himself apart as, you know, more intelligent, more important, more sort of successful. And eventually I got a little mad about it, quite frankly. And decided that I would apply too, just to sort of show that I could also do it. And lo and behold, I got in, which was as shocking to me as, you know, I hadn't told a lot of people that I applied. So when I told people, I'm actually transferring to Yale next year, people were surprised. And I was honestly surprised by it myself. But Yale was a great school, and I had some really great opportunities there.
Your life has been a succession of moving through new frontiers. And how was Yale new to you in a way that you had to really get used to?
You know, growing up in poverty and coming from a community that doesn't have a lot of resources, you don't really understand what the rules of living in these types of privileged communities are. There are status symbols you don't understand. There are unwritten rules that you don't sort of get. And someone described it to me once by saying, it's not that you just don't know the rules of the game. It's that you don't even know that everyone is playing a game. And sometimes by the time you realize that there's sort of a status game being played, you're so far behind that it seems impossible to catch up.
Give me an example of that.
For example, when I was at Yale, a lot of people carried what I now know to be Longchamp purses. And I had, you know, never seen one before in my life. It was almost like part of this staple wardrobe that you had this sort of particular type of bag. And, you know, it was sort of part of your Yale student attire. Because I'd never seen one, I didn't even know necessarily what it was that I was missing. And so I remember sitting in my dorm room one night Googling plastic purses rich girls carry and plastic purses Ivy League. Trying to figure out what these bags were. And of course, then I found one and I was like, you want me to pay how much for a plastic bag? And ended up, you know, spending the next 2 weeks monitoring eBay auctions, trying to buy one as cheaply as I could, a used one, so that I could feel like I had this thing that, you know, in hindsight, it didn't really matter. It didn't help me become a better student. It didn't provide any educational opportunities for me. But at the time, it seemed really important because all of us, I think, when we're in our late teens and early 20s, we just really want to belong. We really want to feel like we're a part of wherever we are. And for me, I always had the sense that I didn't necessarily belong at Yale. I felt like I was an imposter a lot of the time that I was there. And so having these status symbols, I felt like it was the only way to sort of really belong as a Yale student.
And how did your experience there at Yale, how do you draw on it to empower women in the work that you do now?
Yale was a place when I was there that there was still a lot of power sort of had by men, not as much sort of by women. And I really think that that was the start of me being interested in finding ways to change systems to empower women. And that's the work that I started doing as a lawyer after I graduated law school, sort of helping low-income women who were in abusive relationships figure out how to sort of start their lives over and get a fresh start. And it's also the work that I've sort of continued to do in policy settings and in policy environments, trying to figure out how we sort of create systems where people who don't have the resources or the opportunities can still sort of feel like they belong in the systems and like they have opportunities as well.
So you end up going back to Kentucky, and were you tempted by other offers? I mean, as a Harvard Law graduate, was it hard to say, put aside something maybe higher paying and say, I'm going back to Kentucky?
It was. I think for so long, I had been sort of blindly chasing achievement. I sort of thought, you know, oh, going to Yale, that's checking a box. Going to Harvard Law, that's checking a box. The next box to check would be, you know, get a fancy clerkship, get a six-figure legal job in Manhattan. And there was part of me that was really scared not to keep checking the boxes because I realized that that has sort of become how I valued myself and how I defined myself really was just based on my ability to keep checking boxes. But I also knew that just checking the boxes wasn't helping me figure out who I was or what was important to me. And it certainly wasn't helping me have the impact on the world that I wanted to. And I'd come to believe that, you know, I had been the recipient of so many opportunities that other people had given to me. And what I really wanted to do in life was try to pay that forward and create opportunities for other people from the same community that I had come from, sort of low-income rural women in Kentucky. And so there was no sort of box to check that would let me do that. And so for the first time, I sort of ventured off script and started doing my own thing and chasing my own happiness. And it turns out that it was the best decision I ever made.
Which doesn't mean that it's going to be easy, actually, or come naturally. I wonder if you could tell us, it's kind of a funny story, your first case and what you thought of the courtroom when you first walked into it.
Yes, there was definitely a steep learning curve in terms of learning how to be a lawyer. And I remember my first case, I sort of went into court by myself. I had a supervising attorney that sort of thought his job was just to sit in the back and wave at me and laugh as I fumbled my way through a hearing. But I remember I just didn't know where to stand. There were a lot of people in a courtroom, lots of movement, lots of activity. And I couldn't figure out where I was supposed to be at. And I remember sort of just thinking, well, there's a box here. There's this podium stand. It's close to the judge. I'll just get in that. And it turns out that I just walked right into the witness box where really only the witnesses are supposed to be. The attorneys are never supposed to be. And the courtroom bailiff had to kind of nudge me out and be like, no, 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 this is not where you go. But to this day, I remember it. And the first thing I ask when I go into any new courtroom that I don't sort of know how it's set up, I say, now, where do you want me to stand? And where's the judge going to call my case from? And those sorts of logistics. Because once you've been embarrassed like that in front of a whole courtroom full of people, you don't forget it quickly.
I wonder if you see your practice of law as different from maybe, you know, other forms of law, and what's the skill set that you really need in the work that you do?
I believe that all law at its heart should be about telling a good story. And I think that gets lost a lot in some of the more complicated and more business-oriented forms of law. But certainly in the work I do with low-income folks, a lot of it is just sort of telling that person's story and helping to explain sort of what is going on in their lives, especially when you're dealing with survivors of domestic violence. It's sort of helping to empower them to tell their story and talk about things that are really hard for them to talk about, and do that in a way that sort of judges and attorneys and folks understand. And so I really think that too often we forget that that's what law is. I think really storytelling is how a lot of things in our society function. I think, you know, good policy making is also based on good storytelling. And so in my mind, sort of all the different hats I wear as sort of lawyer and policymaker and writer, they all come down to storytelling at their core. And I see a lot of commonalities in them.
Tell us the story of Fatima.
She was a young woman, one of my younger clients, one of my first clients, actually. And she was leaving an abusive relationship. And like so many of the clients, I just remember in her case and in others that I had around the same time, realizing how similar a lot of these clients were, both to me and also to my mom and to my grandma, in terms of, you know, a lot of these clients were sort of first generation folks in college, or, you know, college students with young children, or young women who had been sort of tasked with caring for older or family members who had disabilities. And I just remember looking at them and sort of seeing how different my life could have been with just a few different twists and turns in the road. And I think working with those clients and sort of seeing that commonality and having so much respect for my clients and the choices that they were making and the way they were navigating the world, it really helped me have more respect for my own background and sort of my own relatives and the way that they had navigated poverty and systems that weren't necessarily providing them with opportunities. And so Fatima and many of the other clients that I worked with around that time really helped me come to terms with my own identity and helped me stop feeling like I needed to pretend to have come from some sort of privileged background, and helped me sort of see and take pride in my own background living in poverty.
I don't get the sense from reading your story that there was much, if any, domestic violence in your family's history, the way you tell it. But how prevalent is it in the community you work in now? I mean, you see it every day because you're helping victims, but how prevalent is it throughout the entire community?
It's certainly still very prevalent. I think there's still a lot of ideas around you know, different roles for men and women and sort of what happens in the home. There's still a sense in some families and in some communities that what happens in the home is very private and nobody should be sort of sticking their nose into it. And that sort of secrecy allows domestic violence to continue and to thrive. And, you know, it's certainly changing. It's becoming less tolerated. And I do think that there are more resources and more people sort of doing the work to address it. But it's still, unfortunately, far too common. And it's still something that the community needs to work on, quite frankly.
We haven't talked at all about the opioid crisis, but you do address it in your book, and I'm sure you see it on the ground in your work. Will you tell us the story about the first time you watched someone be sentenced for a drug crime?
Yeah, so after I graduated law school, I spent some time clerking for a federal judge, and most of the crimes that we saw were drug crimes. And so we saw a lot of people just being sentenced for drug crimes. And, you know, I remember what always surprised me was just one, how these people just look like everyday ordinary people, and how they just sort of accepted the court proceedings. And there was often just a sense of hopelessness and resignation. And it was a really sad thing to see day after day, sort of people who were sick and who were struggling with addiction being sentenced one after another after another. And it really gave me this sense of how widespread the opioid addiction crisis was. and really put a human face on it. Once you sort of see those people, and a lot of times you see their families in the courtroom, and you see sort of their children and the devastation, and you can really understand the human impact of all of this.
2020 was a dark year for everybody, and you are really on the front lines helping people whose lives are not easy in the first place. I wonder if you can leave us with your thoughts, and do you have a feeling of hope going forward?
I do. I am hopeful every day when I sort of see the ways that neighbors still help neighbors and communities still take care of their own and come together. And, you know, it certainly is a hard time for so many people, but I see things like communities making sure that kids who would otherwise be hungry get food and people get clothes. And it's a good reminder that we are all in this together, and we are at our best when we sort of lean into our best instincts to take care of each other and lift each other up.
Cassie Chambers Armstrong is a lawyer who works with clients in rural Kentucky. She's also the former vice chair of the Kentucky Democratic Party, and her memoir is Hill Women, Finding Family and a Way Forward in the Appalachian Mountains. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you for having me.
This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor.
And I'm Marcus Smith. Next up, the creator of the YouTube sensation Pasta Grannies. That's a wholesome show if ever there was one. Granny approved and adored by millennials alike.
Si mangia, buon appetito!
Everybody loves pasta, and everybody loves their grandmother. Everybody knows that their grandmother is the best cook. But for Italian grandmothers,
il piatto è pronto.
Traditions of pasta making were dying out. So it was really important for me to do something about it.
Questa è una ricetta antica.
That was Vicky Bennison, creator of the Pasta Granny's YouTube channel. Maybe you're among the nearly 750,000 subscribers to her channel. Even before the pandemic, Bennison was bringing the dying art of regional Italian pasta making from grandmothers, some of them a century old, to kitchens around the world. I'm Marcus Smith, and as host of Constant Wonder, I had the chance to find out how Bennison works her magic, coaxing pasta making secrets out of Italian grandmothers. Right here, I asked her about the urgency behind her project.
I noticed that the skills, these domestic skills of pasta making, sort of stopped at around 65, and that younger women all were going out to work. You know, they were sort of slaves to the school curriculum, and, you know, were busy all the time with their kids and all that kind of thing. It's a similar story everywhere in the world, I think, and that these skills were just not being passed on anymore, that they would go out and buy their pasta, and their children's tastes were changing, that they didn't necessarily want to eat fresh pasta. They were kind of moving in the direction that you do, you know, sort of open the packet of pasta is a much easier thing to do. And so I thought, oh, well, that's, you know, that's a shame. Sort of everybody takes for granted that their grandmother is the best cook, but what granny is going to be cooking in 20 years' time isn't actually the same as what it is at the moment. And so let's make a record of that. And so I started just writing about it, and that wasn't enough, and neither was photography, because pasta making is a very physical thing. You don't really get the sort of the welly, the sort of effort that you put into rolling out or kneading your dough. So that's when I picked up a camera and started filming. My husband's a television producer, so I got a little bit of guidance on it. So to start with, of course, YouTube is where you put this stuff. And so I'd occasionally upload it. And then you kind of become, well, I became vaguely aware that, oh, that, you know, there's an algorithm. And, you know, if you want an audience, then you have to be a slave to that algorithm. You know, you have to upload weekly. And so I started taking it more seriously. And that's how the channel got going.
And why did you settle on doing these grandmothers, these grannies? There is such an appetite for learning how to do food properly and correctly. And you,
yes.
Why not a professional chef?
Well, professional chefs always sort of attribute their inspiration to grandmothers and their mothers, but we never see them. And that was a sort of another motivation for me, was that these women are often off stage, and I wanted to actually sort of put them center stage and celebrate them. We shouldn't be too romantic about the passing of their life styles, which is actually quite hard work, but we should salute them, I think. So that was another reason for putting women there. These women don't put themselves forward either. They're quite shy and retiring and take for granted that they have these skills. They've never actually sort of reflected on that either.
Well, if they're shy and retiring, as you say, putting them on camera might be a bit of a challenge.
Yes, it is.
How do you persuade them to participate with you? I would imagine there are some that maybe some people have actually turned you down and said, "No, I'm not going to do that."
Oh, frequently, even at the front door. I mean, you know, they sort of said, "No, I don't want to be filmed." And it's like, "Oh, but you've said yes until now." So I have a granny finder. She's called Livia Di Giovanni. And I find that even though I speak Italian, it's essential to have an Italian to close the deal, if you like. And she does a marvelous job of persuading people who would normally say no into saying yes. And then the next trick is to make sure that when we do film them, it's like a conversation. We don't come in with, you know, huge cameras, and we film in real time. We don't make them rehearse or anything like that. So we kind of keep it low key and conversational, and they're always very happy to do it. They realize that actually it's not like performing on stage or anything like that. So it becomes an easy experience for them.
You called Livia a granny finder. I think the term might be a granny whisperer is what she really is.
Yes, yes. very much so. I mean, she's remarkable. When you listen to her, she kind of comes around sort of several times. You know, someone may have said no, but then the third time that sort of Livia has come around and sort of talked to her sort of, you know, conversationally, you know, she'll sort of come around, she'll go away, she'll come around. Cool. And they're so bedazzled by the end of it, they say, yeah, okay.
Vicky, I think you've been to the United States to tape as well.
Yes, yes, yes. I was so excited. Only a toe in the water, I went to New York and filmed four women there. And because I was very intrigued to know how recipes change once you've moved to a different country or culture. And also how food helps to maintain traditions when you haven't made that move. So, yes, I sort of found one or two people, and then they actually volunteered. In fact, I've got people nowadays kind of write in and say, oh, I'd love, you know, you to meet my grandmother and film my grandmother. And I say, well, where in the world are you? And they say, you know, San Francisco or somewhere. And I go, well, okay, I'm going to have to find about 10 other grannies to sort of make that trip worthwhile, because cost does come into it. My plans are to sort of visit America again. And also, I seem to be very popular down in Brazil. There seem to be lots of Italians down there, and Australia, places like that that you can visit and actually sort of film some of these women. I'd love to be able to travel the world doing that.
Mm. Well, one of my favorite segments that I was able to see involved a very, very short woman, one of the oldest participants. I can't remember if she was 95, 96, 97. She was nearing 100. And she had to get up on a little stool in order to really...
That's Giuseppe.
And this leads to that question I wanted to ask you about. How much is this series really even about food? Is food front and center stage?
No, I think it's about just as much about the grandmothers as it is about the food. You know, with 5 minute maximum videos, you can't sort of learn too much about them. But if we can sort of learn a little bit about them and about their lives, their environment, you know, if I can get a sort of shot of their kitchen or something like that, I'll try and put it in, or their animals, or if their daughter or granddaughter is around, you know, see if they can join in with the pasta making. I try and sort of add a bit of color that way. Yes, it's equally important, I would say.
Any sense at all from these women that they have any kind of chagrin or worries about what they know and what they have mastered is not being passed on to younger generations.
Yes, they kind of, they're sort of exasperated. And that's, I think, partly why they say yes, so that there is a record of what they do. There are some areas of Italy, like in Romagna, sort of, you know, Bologna and East, where there are still quite a lot of pasta making. So it's not sort of uniform across Italy. But certainly they are very much aware, you know, that they're still cooking for their family because their daughter doesn't do it at all. Is there that social thing of women in their 40s and 50s now? When they were young, they were told sort of that actually to be a modern woman, you gave up the kitchen, you went into work. And that, you know, all this cookery should be left behind. And I think then the next generation have gone, oh, hang on a minute. Well, that's not right. So actually, I find there are quite a lot of younger people who the biggest age group that watches Pasta Grannies is 25 to 35. It's not the older ones.
Fascinating to me.
And I think encouraging. I think food continues to be always more than just simply nutrition and putting food on the table. I mean, for grandmothers, it's about putting love on the table as well. It doesn't matter what your age is, that you respond to that. I like the fact that my program is kind of wholesome. Well, because that's what food is. I think that's important to me anyway.
When I sat down with my children and we watched a few episodes of Pasta Grannies, I'm going to go back to this old woman, nearly 100, Giuseppa. She made a different, two different types of noodle, pasta, but they were shaped differently. And this just leads, is all pasta really the same, but in different shapes and sizes? Can you tell much of the difference?
Yes. There are two main types. There's with egg pasta, which is made with a soft wheat flour, and then there's the durum wheat flour, which you call semolina in America, semolina flour, and that uses only water, and that comes from the south of Italy and also Sardinia. So Giuseppa is from Sardinia, and she would have been she does use the semolina and water pasta type. As an aside, you do find there are other flours that sometimes get used, like buckwheat up in the Alps and that kind of thing. But those are the two main types of pasta. And you're right, there is a limit to what you can do with dough by hand. But the names are extraordinary. You can have one pasta with about six different names, and you can have one name that applies to several different pastas, and it's just very complicated. So the pastas that you get in Sardinia, I mean, you referred to Loriguitas in your introduction, and this is a wonderful kind of pasta that looks like an earring, a sort of hoop earring that is made for All Saints Day. It's a religious pasta, and it's made in one town only called Morgangiore. And Giuseppa doesn't make that because she's down the road. She's up towards Alghero in the northeast of Sardinia, and so she makes these little gnocchi type pastas, and the one that she showed in the film was a one called Macarones di Ungia, and that means fingernail pasta because they're so tiny. That's really sweet.
Well, I wonder, and this is just a conjecture on my part, but the idea that you have a variety of shapes, because maybe otherwise the uniformity would be so stifling that if you come out of economic hardship and maybe this is what you have to eat as something of a staple, at least you get variety in shapes and sizes.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, it changes from village to village. And so, yes, you have variety, but I think the pasta making is mostly a family and a friends kind of group activity. And so you have to have consensus around the table as you make it, because, you know, women used to get together and have a good old gossip. This is a great sort of chance to socialize. And so within that group, you need to agree on the size and the name and never mind what anybody else does, which I think is so it can kind of vary from street to street. And so from the outside, yes, you have variety. But actually, when you're in that village, you have about two or three different pastas that people can agree on and that will be made regularly. So does that make sense?
It does indeed. Vicky Bennison, finally, I want to wrap this up by stepping a little bit away from just this specific series called Pasta Grannies and ask mm-hmm. you a little bit about the general place of this kind of programming in our modern world. What do you think you're doing for people on the whole with food that is presented in a way that is entertainment? Maybe it's food as theater. I'm not sure.
Food is theater, food is love, food that nourishes just not your tummy, but your heart as well. I couldn't have got this past a commissioning editor on terrestrial or cable TV or anything, but I think it so happens that I stumbled across something that I could put on YouTube that has found a niche. I think it strikes a chord with people that it's, I think... I hope it doesn't sound too corny, but you know, you're kind of sharing the love that these women love their families, love being able to put food on the table, and that's an expression of their love. And I think everybody responds to that. I think, yes, I mean, the comments that I get from people is about 30% of the food is great, always the food, but they especially love the grandmothers.
Have you ever thought that this might be because people are responding to programming that is not about elites and is sort of anti-sophistication?
I think that's true, yes. I think food is still fairly democratic in Italy as well. And it's not... It doesn't sort of put up barriers in the way that chefing, you know, it's so precise. Of course, chefs are marvelous and it's great watching them and stuff, but you're not encouraged necessarily, unless you're already a committed, you know, gourmet, into rushing into the kitchen. Whereas I think with the grandmothers, it's like, yeah, you know, share it. You can do this too. It's not difficult.
That was Vicky Bennison, creator of the YouTube channel Pasta Grannies. Henry Ford and Thomas Edison, a little bit like the Elon Musks of their generation, and like Elon Musk, when you unleashed Ford or Edison, you weren't always sure what you're going to get, but there was a good chance it would be worth watching. And when you put Ford and Edison together on a single project, well, you might electrify a literal backwater of America. They aimed to build a futuristic city. Did they pull it off? It's a great story coming up next on Constant Wonder.